broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
When I was a boy, there was but one permanent ambition among my comrades in our village on the west bank of the Mississippi River. That was to be a steamboat man. We had transient ambitions of other sorts, but they were only transient. When a circus came and went, it left us all burning to become clowns. The first Negro minstrel show that came to our section left us all suffering to try that kind of life. Now and then, we had a hope that if we lived and were good, God would permit us to be pirates. These ambitions faded out each in turn, but the ambition to be a steamboat man always remained. Mark Twain, in Life on the Mississippi. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. There's still something magic and alluring about the adventures offered by life on big boats, isn't there? For example, more than 22 million people booked cruises globally in 2014. And more than 23 million cruised the world last year. Like Mark Twain, we're all captivated by what might be around the next bend in the river, or just over the horizon. Or there's even that sense of freedom that movement on the open water offers. Author Jack Shalm captures that spirit beautifully in his book, Lost Chester River Steamboats. Jack is my guest today, and we're going to talk about the steamboats that plied the Chesapeake Bay, and particularly the Chester River. In addition to Lost Chester River Steamboats, Jack is co-author of Majesty at Sea and co-ghostwriter and co-editor of Night Boat on the Potomac. Jack is also a veteran reporter who has worked in both print and broadcast journalism in Baltimore and on the Delmarva Peninsula. Jack, welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
My pleasure, Hal. I'm looking forward to it.
Jack, from his writings, we're familiar with Mark Twain and his fascination with steamboats on the Mississippi. But how did you become interested in these majestic boats?
Well, when I was 8 years old, we were living in Baltimore. I'm a native of Baltimore. My mother was a nurse at what was then the Marine Hospital, where she cared for officers and seamen of the Merchant Marine. And one of her patients was a captain on one of the Old Bay Line overnight steamers between Baltimore and Norfolk. And they got to be pretty good friends. And he said, well, bring your family and come on. Let's go down the bay sometime this summer. So we booked a trip, overnight trip, Baltimore to Norfolk, 12-hour overnight trip on a vintage steamboat that was built in 1913. So here you've got all of the trappings of the late Victorian era, the stained glass windows, the chandeliers, the wrought iron railings and everything.
Jack, so I can get the picture here. Was this a paddle wheel steamer with paddle wheels on either side? Was it a propeller driven steamer? What were you on here?
We were on a propeller driven steamer. They had paddle wheelers, obviously, back in the 19th century, but in the first decade of the 20th century, they went over to basically propeller steamers. So here we are. I'm on this boat. My family knows the captain. The captain takes me under his wing that night. I get up in the pilot house. I get to handle that great big wooden wheel, blow the whistle, and look at the radar. So by the next morning, I am totally captivated. How could an 8-year-old not be captivated by something like that? And that really got me going. And then the next year, the publication of Walter Lord's book, A Night to Remember, on the sinking of the Titanic, just cemented it. And I have been hooked ever since.
I want to ask you if you would read the opening paragraph to the introduction to your book, in which you tell us that story about being an eight-year-old. Mm-hmm. Would you read that paragraph?
Sure.
For mm-hmm. us?
When I was 8 years old, my parents took me on an overnight trip down Chesapeake Bay from Baltimore to Norfolk on the venerable steamboat City of Richmond of the old Bay Line. It was only a 12-hour voyage, but for me it might as well have been a transatlantic crossing on the Queen Mary. I was mesmerized about everything as I walked through the corridors of that 1913 vintage steamer, the polished interior woodwork, the brass facing on the main staircase, the stained glass domes over the main saloon, and yes, that's what it was called, a saloon, the gentle pulsing of the engine far below, the rich tones of the steam whistle as it echoed across the water.
And you were hooked.
Hooked, line and sinker.
Well, let me ask you, because of Mark Twain and because of the musical Showboat from 1927 and its subsequent revivals through the years, and many other Mississippi River steamboat setting, I think we're generally familiar with steamboats on the Mississippi and the romance of the steamboat on the Mississippi. Why aren't we as familiar with steamboats on the Chesapeake Bay? Because I assume, and you'll tell us about this, the bay was filled with steamboats, not just the Chester River. Why aren't we familiar? Why aren't they as romantic for us as the Mississippi River?
I think it's because of Mark Twain to a large extent and his writings. When you say steamboat to people today, they immediately think of a Mississippi River style boat with the stern paddle wheel, the decks very high, the long smokestacks up at the top. And I think the reason that people aren't as aware of steamboats on the Chesapeake Bay today is simply because we didn't have a Mark Twain. Now, Gilbert Byron has touched on steamboats in some of his writings, and I wish he had written an entire book on it because he might have become the Chesapeake Bay's Mark Twain. But fortunately, there are a number of excellent books that were written on steamboats. Authors like Alexander Crosby Brown, Bob Burgess, Graham Wood, and David Holly. But the books may be hard to find now because they came out so long ago. And although the steamboat was a major, major part of the local Chesapeake Bay economy in the 19th and into the early 20th century, it seems to have faded into obscurity. There's very little around to remind us of it. There's very little physical, only a few pilings of old wharves and that sort of thing, and a museum down on the on the western shore of Virginia has the pilot house off of one of the steamers. That's by far the largest artifact. But you get beyond that, and there's not much else out there.
Jack, we all have our image, I think, of the Mississippi River steamboat. But tell us a little bit about steamboats. What was a steamboat, and what was the era of the steamboats?
Well, the era was a very long one. The very first steamboat on the Chesapeake Bay ran in 1813. Was actually chased by the British Admiral during the War of 1812 on the Chesapeake, but he never caught her. And it lasted until 1962, believe it or not. Steamboats on the Chesapeake Bay were, you could look at a picture of one of them and sort of think that's a small ocean liner because the design was very similar. We didn't have stern wheelers on the bay. We had side wheelers, but they were shaped much the same as an ocean-going passenger ship. Several decks with staterooms, nice wheelhouse at the front, funnel on the top, windows all lighted up at night, and they were driven by reciprocating engines. Those are the old up and down type of engines. But the boats weren't terribly large, especially the ones that went up and down the rivers. They might be 180 feet, 200 feet, because they had to maneuver these small rivers. And one of the rivers that was most problematical for them was the Wicomico coming into Salisbury. And for the longest time, they didn't have any steamboats coming up to Salisbury because they didn't think they could get a wide side wheeler up the Wicomico River. And it wasn't until some captain decided to be bold and give it a try that they realized that they could, in fact, do it. Now, most of these ships were, as I say, only about 180, no more than 200 feet long. Now, the big overnight boats down to Norfolk, they were 300, 310, 330 feet in length.
How many people would they carry?
The river boats probably would have only carried about maybe 100, 150, but the night boats, because they were so much bigger and had so many more accommodations, so many more staterooms, they could carry 300 to 400.
Well, your book tells us about steamboats on the Chester River. I'm not sure how many people know where the Chester River is, mm-hmm. and why the Chester River was important both to you and important to the steamboat business.
Chester River's on the upper eastern shore. If you look at a map and go directly across east from Baltimore, it's just a little south of where Baltimore is. If you look at the map, the Chester River begins in Delaware, winds its way. It's the border between Kent and Queen Anne's counties, and then opens up down just above Kent Island into the open bay. And the steamer was extremely important for a river like that back in the early days, because if you had to get to the other side, obviously there was no bridge, there were no highways, no cars, there were no railroads until the middle to latter part of the 19th century. So you took a sailing vessel. You take a sailing vessel on a river that winds all over the place, and you're going to find situations where you get becalmed and you sit there and you don't go anywhere for the longest time. So when the steamer came along, here was a reliable form of transportation that took both passengers and cargo back and forth between the Chester and the and Baltimore. And the reason I got interested in this is because we live about half mile from the Chester River, and I knew vaguely about the steamboat era on the Chester, and I thought, well, this bears looking into. And that's how I came to write the book.
Well, I guess Isaac Watts was the developer of the steam engine, or the inventor of the steam engine. How did the steam engine get developed for nautical use?
I think it had its origins in England with railroads, and I forget the name of the gentleman in England who pioneered it, but they basically applied the idea of an engine that went up and down or sideways on a train and put it in a ship. The earliest steamboats were simply open vessels, a hull sitting in the water, big boiler in the middle, the engine next to it, and very little space for much of anything else. There's still some question about who actually pioneered it in the United States. James Rumsey on the Potomac River had a steamer running out of Shepherdstown, West Virginia in the 1790s. He got George Washington interested in it. Then there was John Fitch, and then, of course, Robert Fulton. And Robert Fulton gets a lot of the credit today, primarily because he had the ear of Robert Livingston, who also happened to have a lot of money and basically was Fulton's PR man. And so that's how so many people tend to think that the boat on the Hudson River was the pioneering steamboat, and it's often been called the Clermont, but its real name was Hudson North River Steamboat. Clermont was the name of Livingston's home.
How prolific? You talk in your book primarily about the steamships out of Baltimore, mm-hmm. that came over and went up the Chester River. How prolific were steamboats nationally and also on the Chesapeake Bay? You've touched on that, mm-hmm. a little bit with the excursions from Baltimore down to Norfolk, but mm-hmm. but how prolific were they nationally? How important nationally, and how important to the Chesapeake Bay?
Well, they were very important nationally because, again, we go back to the era of sail. You needed something a little bit more reliable. So you had a lot of steamers running between Maine and Massachusetts, out around the Cape Cod Canal to New York, to Boston. You had the boats here in the Chesapeake. You had them further down on the Savannah River and the St. Johns River in Florida. There were the Mississippi boats that did not only the Mississippi, but the Ohio River system as well. And there were even some small steamboats out on some of the rivers way out west in some of the lands that we don't think have much water, but yet there were rivers out there, and these boats ran on them. And they were similar to the ones that ran on the inland rivers. They were very similar to what the ones were on the Mississippi. And you had some on the West Coast, but not quite as much because the West Coast doesn't have the river system, for instance, that we have here in the Chesapeake Bay. So if you had steamers on the West Coast, it might have been a run between San Francisco and Los Angeles or up to Seattle or to Portland. Now, here in the Bay, because we have so many rivers, you know, they say up to 4,000 miles of shoreline if you take into account all the rivers. And I dare say that there were boats running from Baltimore up every river in the Chesapeake Bay Territory. Rivers nobody's ever heard of, like the Piankatank or the Ockahannock and places like that down in Virginia. And for some reason, even though you've got the big city of Norfolk down at the southern end of the bay, all of the steamers, even the ones that went down into Virginia, were based in Baltimore because that was the real hub. And one of the reasons later on that Baltimore was the hub is because the railroads came in there and the cargo and the passengers from the steamboats could easily be transshipped to the railroad to head out west.
So there are a number of different kinds of steamboats. I'm assuming that the majority of the steamboats carried not just passengers, but some kind of produce or some kind of economic goods as well, and that. From your book, I understand that was particularly true of the area around the Chester River as well.
And it would have applied for most of the rivers on the Eastern Shore because, again, the farmers on the Eastern Shore wanted to get their livestock and their produce to market over to Baltimore. And in the case of the produce, you obviously wanted to get it there as quickly as you could so that it didn't spoil and that sort of thing. So, yeah, the boats carried a lot of cargo. In fact, if you look at a picture of a steamboat, the first deck above the water that goes all the way from the bow to the stern was given over primarily to carrying cargo. They also carried livestock. The boats going from the Eastern Shore over to Baltimore, they would not only have had livestock, but they would have had crops grown in the area, oysters, crabs, fish, and in the early days, tobacco. And then from Baltimore, coming back, they would have brought tools and building materials and manufactured goods and medicines, all the sorts of things that weren't readily available here on the Eastern Shore. And then, of course, the passengers used the boats for any number of things. They might go to the big city just to go to the big city. They might go to visit relatives, to do a doctor's appointment, to go shopping, and that sort of thing. So it was important both from an individual's point of view as well as the shipper.
Peaches and tomatoes come to mind here. Out of Chester Town, for instance, on the Chester River, and the area here. What did they carry in addition to peaches and tomatoes? And why don't we have a lot of peaches and tomatoes around anymore?
Well, the story with the peaches and tomatoes is attributable to a nasty blight that came through in the 1890s. But prior to that, the area up around Chestertown, on both sides of the Chester River in Queen Anne's and Kent counties, was considered to be the largest peach-producing area in the whole world. So this was an enormous business for the boats. And in the middle of peach season, it wasn't uncommon to see the bushel baskets piled all the way to the overhead on the freight decks of these boats. And sometimes they had to charter additional steamers to come over to get all of the crop over to the Eastern Shore. Same thing with tomatoes. They also carried grains as well. And then later on, some of the cargoes might have been something like huge rolls of newsprint, huge rolls of electrical cable. They carried steel as a building supply, kapok, the stuff used for stuffing different things, and beer was a big commodity.
Which way did the beer go?
I think it went both ways.
Well, it went one way in the passengers, but it also went in barrels and so forth.
But the thing that made the boat such an attractive trip was in the case of the Chester, and this applies for all of the other rivers as well. You start out from, say, Chestertown. You go down, you tie up at a dock on this side of the river. You load the cargo and a couple of people. As you go down a little further, tie up on the other side. Same thing. And you go back and forth all the way down the river, and then you go to Baltimore. But one of the big drawing cards on these these boats were day boats. They didn't run at night. One of the big drawing cards was the cuisine on the steamboats. Chesapeake Bay steamboats were known far and wide for the food they served, and that was one of the big drawing cards and a lot of the reason, one of the reasons that a lot of people took the boat rather than try some other method of transportation, because back in the 19th, if you needed to get across the bay, you had to go up and around. And in the early days, it would have been on a stagecoach. The roads would have been dusty. They would have been muddy. Heaven knows when you would get there and in what kind of condition. But if you look at any of the old advertising brochures for these steamboats, they really pushed their cuisine. And it was outstanding Southern cooking, Chesapeake Bay cooking.
What am I eating if I'm on one of these boats?
Well, oysters, obviously, crabs. Some clams. You would have had produce from the farm fields, corn, whatnot.
All fresh stuff, obviously.
All absolutely fresh. What was served on a crossing of the bay came on board that morning.
What in general was a crossing in terms of time?
With most of the steamers from, say, from Chestertown over to Baltimore, it was probably about 8 hours by the time you made all the stops on the river and headed across the bay. The Chestertown is about 27 miles above the mouth of the Chester River. Then when you get to the mouth, it's a straight shot across the bay, up slightly and up the Patapsco River into Baltimore.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful trip to me. What was the cost?
A lot of people laugh at this. Back in the 19th century, it might have been 25 cents.
Yeah.
If you've got a meal, maybe another 25 cents. But I have brochures for those Norfolk boats, and they were the last ones to run. In 1960, a ticket, just a ticket, was $10. And depending on the class of stateroom that you wanted, it could be anywhere from $3.50 to $5, even in 1960 and 61.
So what was the time of that Baltimore to Norfolk excursion?
That was a 12-hour run. They left Baltimore at 6:30 in the evening, again timed.
So they ran overnight.
They were overnight boats. That departure was timed partially so that the passengers would come on board and have dinner on the ship as they headed down. And then you had time in the morning to have breakfast on board before you got off.
Were these primarily called excursion boats? Is that what I understand
not the ones that carried passengers and freight. Well, excursion boats were pleasure trips. For instance, one of the big pleasure trips out of Baltimore was from over the bay to Kent County to a place called Tallchester Beach, where they had an amusement park, hotel, and a nice beach. Betterton Beach was another place. The boat would go in the morning with thousands of people on board. They take their picnic baskets and go ashore and spend the day at the beach.
Wait a minute, Jack. Thousands of people on board?
On the big ones.
And how big were those boats would carry thousands of people?
The biggest one on the bay was a boat called the Dreamland, and she was close to 300 feet long, but they didn't have staterooms, so they had a lot of open space in them. That boat could carry 4,000 people.
Holy smoke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not sure how easy it would have been to get them off if there was an emergency, but you look at pictures, and it looks like the people are just packed in there.
Well, I want to ask you about emergencies in just a minute, but before that, there were these excursion boats, and I understand there were also packet boats. Mm-hmm. What is a packet boat?
The boats between Baltimore and Norfolk were packet boats. They were essentially from point A to point B, no stops along the way, sort of like the local version of the ships between New York and Southampton, transportation from point A to point B. They didn't go up the rivers. They didn't stop along the way or any of that sort of thing. So that's the basic term for a packet boat. The ones that went up and down the rivers that made all those stops, they didn't have a name like that. They were simply passenger and freight steamers.
From Crisfield over to Smith Island, I believe, there is, quote, a packet boat that runs every day that carries the mail. Mm-hmm. Am I accurate in calling that a packet boat?
You could, because it's between point A and point B, and it operates on a regular schedule. I mean, these night boats between Baltimore and Norfolk ran 365 days a year in all kinds of weather. So this is not just a warm weather junket. There are some phenomenal photographs showing the boats out there, and the bay is completely covered with 2 and 3 foot ice floes. And they, more than one of them, spent some time trapped in an ice floe before they could get free.
Did they have icebreakers on the bay then?
They had some. The city of Baltimore had two of them, which was, interestingly, they were sidewheelers. But they had iron hulls, and the bow was done in such a way that this icebreaker would come up, it would ride up on a floe, and then the weight of the boat would break up the ice. They lasted until 1960, and then they were broken up because they were so old. But the very next year, 1961, one of the old Bay Line steamers, the one that I was so enamored of as a kid, got stuck in the ice right above the Chesapeake Bay and was stuck out there for 12 hours. And they had to bring two Coast Guard icebreakers out to try to break her free.
Mm-hmm. Well, what role? This was the era of the Civil War and also into the war and also the War of 1812 and then on into the First World War. What kind of role did these boats play, for instance, in the War of 1812 and then in the Civil War and in the First World War?
Well, there was only the one boat on the bay during the War of 1812, but the British Admiral Cockburn, wanted to capture it so badly.
Why did he want that boat?
He just felt that that offered us a type of technology that the British could make use of in their marauding up and down the Chesapeake Bay. And he only missed her by a couple of hours a few times. But then the Civil War came along, and the boats played quite a role. A lot of them were requisitioned by the U.S. government to carry troops. There were two Chesapeake Bay boats in General Burnside's expedition down to Hatteras Island in North Carolina carrying troops. Some of them carried the mails. Now, the Chesapeake remained in Union hands all through the war between the states, so the boats didn't go all the way to Norfolk at that point. They went down as far as Old Point Comfort, and they would carry the mails, and they'd carry passengers and so forth. A couple of boats didn't make it out of the Civil War. One was burned by the Confederates when they were evacuating Norfolk, and one or two others piled up on the shoals down at Cape Hatteras. But then you get into the more modern wars, World War I, World War II. The steamers, and I'm talking now primarily about the big overnight boats. The little river boats didn't do this sort of thing, but the big overnight boats, they carried enormous numbers of troops in World War I between Baltimore from the north down to Hampton Roads, which was a port of embarkation for soldiers heading overseas. So while they weren't actually called up for military service, they were used for that purpose, almost to an extent that a civilian couldn't find a space on board because there were so many troops. Then in World War II, this is a tremendous story. Four of the Chesapeake Bay boats were requisitioned by the government. They were lend-leased to the British. They were boarded up. They had their staterooms torn out. They were boarded up to make a crossing of the Atlantic Ocean in September 1942, when the gales were at their worst on the North Atlantic. The U-boats were running amok in the North Atlantic.
I mean, these weren't transported. These boats sailed across the ocean.
They sailed across the ocean, but they were never meant to even be in the ocean. And here they're sending them across because the British had need of those vessels as coastal freight vessels, coastal transports around the British Isles, across the English Channel with an eye toward D-Day. And these kinds of boats were ideal for that because they didn't draw that much water. They drew about 16, 18 feet of water, whereas a deep sea ship might draw as much as 30, depending on how big it was. And so they found themselves being used for those kinds of purposes once they got over there. But several of them didn't make it because the convoy that they went over in was attacked by German submarines. And apparently it was a fierce battle. And German propaganda said that we sank transports of the Queen Mary class. So the Queen Mary's 1,000 feet long, and you got a 300-foot steamboat here.
And in an attack, these boats are kind of just sitting there. They've got no protection except the ships around them.
That's basically it. They had two old British destroyer escorts to guard eight ships. It was almost an impossible task. And because these vessels were relatively light in terms of construction as opposed to a deep sea ship.
Were these wood or metal now?
They were steel hulls. They were steel hulls. Some of them had wooden superstructures. But when a torpedo hit one of them, it practically obliterated the boat. And three of them were sunk on the way over.
And do you have a sense of how many made it across?
Well, that convoy, there was only the one convoy, and there were eight of them, so three, three didn't make it. And then one of the vessels, ship called the President Warfield, which ran between Baltimore and Norfolk, 2 weeks after D-Day, she went over to Omaha Beach and became the headquarters ship for the Allied brass that were managing the assault into France.
So they played quite a role late in their history, mm-hmm. actually. Let me ask you. You mentioned the largest steamboat was the Dreamland, and that carried 4,000.
Mm-hmm.
I find that
it is amazing.
I'm having trouble imagining that. Mark Twain was quite enamored of the captains of these steamboats on the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Who were the captains generally of these boats, and why were they so revered? And in fact, were they revered?
Yeah, I think they were, because in almost every case, the captains of these vessels, as well as the other officers, were men who were natives of the area. They were born along the waterways. Gloucester County, Virginia, was a veritable breeding ground of Chesapeake Bay steamboatmen for some reason. But they made their way up through the ranks. Most of them would begin as a crewman, ordinary seaman, and then go up maybe to a mate or something, and then would eventually make it to captain. You didn't have any maritime academies back in those days for steamboat captains. And the other thing that made these men so remarkable was that they knew the waters of the Chesapeake and its rivers just like the back of their hand. And those that ran at night really had to have that sixth sense. There was a story that was told to me by a captain of one of the steamers that ran from Washington to Norfolk. In 1918, the bay was completely frozen over. They didn't move for a month. So the captain cooled his heels down in Norfolk for a month. And then when the ice finally started to break up, they headed up during the day just so that they could see everything. They found that when they got out in the open bay that the ice had moved all of the channel markers off station. They had no idea where the channel was. But somehow, because of that sixth sense, they were able to steer the steamer not only up the bay, but then in the Potomac River, which is notorious for its shoals. So, yeah, they were really something, and they were really looked upon by passengers with the same amount of awe, I think, that a passenger might have looked upon a captain of a transatlantic liner.
Jack, there was a time when I sailed my sailboat all over the bay, and I can tell you now how valuable those channel markers are. Mm-hmm. And I had mud on the keel of my boat more than once to testify to misreading.
Apparently very rare is the boat person in the Chesapeake who hasn't touched ground at one time or another.
That's right. My guest today is Jack Shalm, author of Lost Chester River Steamboats. We're going to take a short break now, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Jack about how safe these boats were. We've already heard about the horrors of crossing the Atlantic, for instance, during the Second World War, but how safe were they just plying the Mississippi River and the rivers of our country and the Chesapeake Bay. Please stay with us. You'll hear a little bit about explosions.
I'm Tom Pittman, and I hope you can join me for the Vintage Country Show, where we present the best in country music from World War II to Watergate. That's this Friday and every Friday at 8 p.m. on WSDL 90.7 Rhythm and News.
Hi, this is Steve Martin, the host of Unreal Bluegrass. Each week, we'll bring you a wide range of bluegrass from the innovative artists of today to the traditional pickers from yesteryear. All this and interviews with players from all walks of life. That's 3 hours of Unreal Bluegrass every Sunday at 7 p.m. on WSDL 90.7 FM, Rhythm and News.
Welcome back to Delmarva Today Writers Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. My guest today is author and journalist Jack Schaum. We've been talking about his boat, Lost Chester River Steamboats, and we're going to continue that discussion by talking about how safe these boats were. We've got a huge buildup of steam throbbing away in the hull of this ship, Jack. How safe were these boats?
In the early days, you were taking a chance because the maritime steam engine was still being developed well into the middle part of the 19th century. And the steamer back in those days, in order to try to minimize any potential explosion or fire, the boilers were put off to the sides of the ship up on deck so that if anything happened, it would blow out and it wouldn't necessarily destroy the boat. Later on, and of course you would have seen the smokestacks on both sides instead of fore and aft like you normally do. 1840 saw the worst steamboat accident on the Chesapeake Bay when a brand new boat named the Medora, she was a sidewheeler, was making her first trip out of Baltimore. The paddle wheels turned two times and the boiler exploded. And this boiler was in the ship and it just sent debris and bodies and everything flying all over the place. And for weeks they were bringing people up from the bottom of Baltimore Harbor. Amazingly, the ship was rebuilt, given a new name, and lasted until about 1870. So that was a problem early on. I would say that once you get past the middle of the 19th century, as far as any concern over explosions, that was probably minimal. Now, fire was always a problem because the boats had wooden superstructures. Some had wooden hulls in the early days as well as wooden superstructures.
They were burning wood and they were burning coal. What were they burning?
In the early days, it would have been pine logs primarily, and then they went over to coal. And it was only the last few boats that were built on the bay that were fired by oil in the 1920s. But with the wooden hulls, and wooden superstructures, if a fire got started, it was usually all over. And there were several bad fires on the bay. But when you look at the number of sailings that took place, the number of vessels that were out there against the number of disasters like that, it really was very small.
Jack, most men, if they have control of any kind of machine, and there is someone else in the vicinity with a similar kind of machine, they are going to race. I know that there were steamboat races on the Mississippi, and there's a famous one that I'll ask you about. How about on the Chesapeake Bay? Did these captains get the urge or desire to race these boats on the bay? And was there any kind of danger in their racing?
Let's put it this way: there were no sanctioned races on the Chesapeake Bay. I think the so-called race on the Mississippi with the Robert E. Lee, yeah, that was sanctioned and that was pumped up big time. But around here, management always said that you know you're not supposed to race, even though there were more than one boat going to the same destination. But it happened all the time, and it would be a ship. One steamer went out first, and then another one would go out a little bit later, and then they'd get close to each other, and the passengers on one boat would be shouting over to the passengers on the other boat, and you're no good, and we're going to beat you, and so forth and so on. There were newspaper articles in the Sun paper in the early part of the 20th century talking about the fact that there were races, but nobody would admit that they were really racing. Gosh, we just happened to be down there, and that other boat was there, and we were faster than they were. So management would look the other way.
Any mishaps?
No, not with racing, fortunately. Racing. That's a good thing.
Yeah, no, that is a good thing. But it does occur to me that male or female, there is something in our nature that causes us to want to race if we're if we're on a track with someone in a similar vehicle.
A lot of these boats, they weren't very fast. They didn't have to be fast because
how fast were they?
Right. Okay. The ones that went up and down the rivers, the side wheelers, they maybe did. And for some reason in the Chesapeake, they measured speed by miles per hour, not knots. Mm. I don't know why. I've never been able to find out. But the river boats would maybe do 10, 11 knots. They just kind of sashayed along because they had to do all of this going back and forth between the wharves. Night boats to Norfolk, 17, 18 miles an hour. And they could make the trip in 12 hours. But if they got delayed along the way, there was enough reserve of speed that they could kick that in and use it if need be. So they weren't terribly fast, and that may be one reason why racing was never officially sanctioned or what have you. On the Atlantic, for instance, the idea was to build the biggest and the fastest liner you could, and the fastest one of them all is the SS United States, which went close to 40 land miles an hour.
Right. And that was a marketing tool
big time.
For those boats. We'll
the
get you there quicker.
Fastest ship in the world, you know.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll get you there we'll get you there quicker. Why we don't see steamboats on the Chesapeake Bay. I know. I'm assuming not on the Mississippi River either. Except for the excursion boats out of New Orleans and maybe Natchez and maybe St. Louis, I don't know. But what led to their demise as a delivery mechanism?
Well, it was improved roads, paved roads taking the place of the dusty roads that the stagecoaches would have had to ride on going up and around the bay. You would have had improved vehicles. Trucks that were carrying some of that cargo could drive up and around and maybe get it to a market faster, perhaps, depending on what was going on. Then the railroads made inroads, particularly into the Eastern Shore in the latter part of the 19th century. In fact, toward the end, the Pennsylvania Railroad was a big presence on the Eastern Shore, and it ended up owning most of the steamboat companies. So here was a system of steamer would come, deliver to our trains, and we head up north. Now, the Baltimore faction didn't particularly care for that because Baltimore wasn't getting any of that business. It was just going up the Delmarva Peninsula to Philadelphia and New York. So those were problems. Cargo loadings trailed off. Number of passengers trailed off. It was no longer the quick way to get from one place to another. Then the other thing that was a big problem, and not only locally but out on the high seas as well, were the wages that had to be paid to American seamen. They were very, very high compared to what it would have been like on a foreign flag vessel. And but saying that, you couldn't run a foreign flag vessel in domestic waters. That was simply against the law. So those were the reasons primarily. And in the case of the last two night boats between Baltimore and Norfolk, they simply got very old. When they ended operations in 1962, the city of Norfolk was 51 years old and the city of Richmond was 49 years old. And that's a long time to run a vessel, especially a wooden-hulled vessel, and the maintenance toward the end became insufferable.
Yeah. So they were just too expensive to build now.
After World War II.
To maintain.
Yeah, after World War II, the old Bay Line wanted to see about replacing those ships that were taken overseas during the war. And the government eventually got around to paying the company for those boats. But because shipbuilding costs had risen so dramatically during and after the war, what they got from the government in return for taking four vessels couldn't even cover the cost of one new one.
Well, Jack, you tell us that the trains were operating on the Eastern Shore here. And I think I read in your book that you could take a train almost from Kent Island to the beaches. Mm-hmm. Where sitting on Route 404 the other day, going to Rehoboth, I kept saying to myself, "Where is the train? Where is the train?" What happened to those trains, Jack?
Well, the highway is what happened to the trains. Everybody wanted to drive their own cars. If you go down the Delmarva Peninsula, down into Virginia, down toward the mouth of the bay, the rail line is still there right next to Highway 13, but it doesn't carry much any longer because you've got so many trucks on the road. You've got people driving their own cars. And what railroad lines are left, they're just not in the best of condition. So there's trains can't go as fast as they did back then. You've still got some freight railroads on the Eastern Shore, but they're very, very few and far between. When that line down to Cape Charles was being operated in its heyday, the trains would go 100 miles an hour going down there. The Delmarva Express, the Chesapeake Express, or what have you. And they'd connect with a steamer down there to take them across the mouth of the bay. Now, you mentioned Kent Island. That was an interesting deal because when the railroads and when some of the railroads and some of the steamboat lines amalgamated, they came up with the idea of a joint service. Take a steamer from downtown Baltimore to Kent Island. Maybe it took you an hour, hour and a half. You get on the train at Kent Island, and you would go over to Rehoboth or Lewis, Delaware, or you would get a train, or you would take a steamer from Baltimore down to Claiborne in Talbot County, and you take the train down to Ocean City. Might take 3 or 4 hours. Now stop and think. How long do you wait in line on Route 404 or at the Bay Bridge or Route I-97 and all of this sort of thing? I think if you take the time factor, how long it took the combination train and boat to get there and how long it takes you to get there today with your long waits, I think the train and boat measures up pretty well.
I would think that they might. With the demise of the steamboat industry, what happened to these small towns that were not such small towns when the steamboats were stopping at them?
Well, some of the small towns, and there were some very, very small ones along the way, some of them, they just kind of disappeared over time.
Love Point, not a town, but Love Point comes to mind. Mm-hmm. Here on Kent Island. That was a fairly large center of activity, wasn't it?
They tried to develop it as a resort. They built a big hotel there, the Love Point Hotel, which lasted until the 1960s, and there were plans also for an amusement park and all of that sort of thing there. So, but Love Point today is a residential area. The old pier where the double-ended automobile carrying ferry came in from Baltimore is still there and still being used by a company that's on Love Point, but you'd have to look really hard to find any evidence of what once had been.
Queenstown is another example.
Right, Queenstown, if the tide's extremely low, you might see some of the old pilings poking out of the waters of Little Queenstown Creek. But as far as buildings and all of that sort of thing, they're all pretty much all gone.
So the economies were just withered away as a result.
Or it shifted to something else, perhaps. Queenstown's a nice little town, but it really has no commercial activity. Love Point certainly doesn't.
Well, it doesn't have the Ferris wheel anymore.
No.
Which I found very, very interesting. Jack, your book is just delightful, Lost Chester River Steamboats. But you were also a print and radio journalist as well. I'd like to ask you a little bit about your life as a journalist and the kind of writing that you did as a journalist. Tell us a little bit about what it means to write for a newspaper or magazine.
It's been a very rewarding career because I've done not just one thing, but I've done several things, newspapers, radio, public relations. But I got started in the journalism business when I was in college in Baltimore in the mid-1960s. I was going to night school at the University of Baltimore, and I was taking journalism courses. A second cousin of mine who had been a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer suggested one time after reading something that I wrote, maybe you ought to go into journalism. So I was going to be an American history teacher, but somehow or another I fell off the wagon and wound up into journalism. But I was attending classes at the University of Baltimore. One of my professors was a retired Baltimore Sun editor. And after several weeks, he called me aside. He said, the News American is hiring reporters, and I think you should apply. So I went to the News American, which was the other big daily in Baltimore in those days, and I got hired. Here I am still in college. I get hired to go to work as a reporter on a major metropolitan newspaper. Now, granted, I didn't cover City Hall. We went out and covered the rural areas, but that was how it got started. And I was there for 5 years, and then I went to Washington for a year as the press aide to Congressman William Mills, who once represented the Eastern Shore. I had a brief respite in the public relations business after that. And in 1975, I went with WBAL Radio, and I was there almost 30 years as a radio news anchor and reporter. Interestingly, my very first newspaper article, which I still have, was a story about the lighthouse at the head of the Chesapeake Bay that ships would hone in on as they came out of the Chesapeake and Delaware Canal. So there's always a maritime interest lurking very nearby.
How did you learn to write? Did you learn to write in college? Did you learn to write on the job? Why did they hire you?
Well, I had been writing since I was a little kid, and I had a friend who was equally interested in the ships, and we would write our own little fiction stories, being guided by, say, the book on the Titanic, and we write our own stories, and we get on the telephone, and we'd read our stories back and forth to each other.
Wonderful.
And I've still got some of those, and they actually weren't half bad. I think it came natural. There was never any particular coaching. I mean, I took the English classes like everybody else, and some news writing classes and what have you. But it just sort of seemed to develop. And I was a typist of the old school from the very beginning. I was a two-finger typist, and I still am. And I think I can keep up with the best of them.
Well, as a journalist, I understand that that you have deadlines, and you have to write fast, and you have to collect information that you're going to write quickly. You've got to organize it. You've got to have it somewhat accurate and get it in. How did you learn to do that? How do you develop that skill? And particularly, I'm asking this because of the people in our audience who might want to try journalistic writing. How do you develop that skill?
Part of it is by doing. You know, you just start out, okay, when I first started typing stories, it wasn't very quick, and I might have missed a deadline. The other part of it that, plays an important role is organizational skills, being organized, to be able to think ahead. Okay, I've got this assignment. What do I have to do between now and the time that it either goes to press or it goes on the air, whatever the case may be? Try to think it out in advance and then approach it from that point of view. Maybe do this part of it here, do that part of it there, and so forth, so that the whole will come together. I think if anyone's interested in getting into the business, it's a good thing to get into some sort of journalism program. They're out there with a number of the different colleges. But I think in my case, I was just fortunate that it sort of came naturally. I've never had very many editors chasing me around saying, why did you write this, or this is lousy, or what have you. I've been very lucky where that was concerned.
Well, we all know who, where, what, when, and why, with mostly who, what, where, and when. What other, in addition, journalistically, to hitting making sure you hit those topics, is there another pattern to writing a journalistic piece?
Not really. I don't think so. I think what you need to do when you're writing a news story is you have to have something right at the beginning that's going to grab people. It's not necessarily the who, what, where, and why, but I can't think of anything at the moment. You might just make a statement, or you might use a quote and then go from there. Something that would make the reader see that and want to read the whole thing. And I basically think that's it. You want it to be interesting. You want it to be lively. And I've often said that a very, very long newspaper story doesn't necessarily make a very good newspaper story. You can do a good, concise story in half the space that some people would do a really long one. And I think after a while, if you get a really long story, a reader's attention starts to flag unless it's absolutely riveting.
What's the most interesting story? And I know this. There are, like the people on the steamboat, there are thousands of stories that you've got. What comes to your mind is the most interesting you worked on?
The most interesting was a story that I did while I worked over here for the weekly papers for the Bay Times and the Record Observer up in Queen Anne's County in 2010. The Queen Anne's County sent an educational delegation to China, and I went along on that trip to cover this event. And it was just a fascinating experience. I never had dreamed that I would be going to the Orient, but we spent 10 days there. I was interviewing high-ranking people in Beijing and Suzhou and Shanghai and transmitting this material back to the paper every day. Never in my wildest dreams did I think I'd go halfway around the world to cover a story. But local, nearer to home, I had been part of the team covering the Pope coming to Baltimore a couple of times when Jimmy Carter was president, covering him. And obviously, you know, the other things that we don't like to think about necessarily, the space shuttle explosions and that sort of thing. But if anything stands out, it's got to be that trip to China, just because it was so different.
Right, right. You've got to know something. In addition to being able to write, you've got to know something as a journalist. What do you need to know, and what would you advise young people today who want to get into the business of journalism? What do they need to know?
I think they need to know a lot about the world around them. Not necessarily just assume that something is there, but why is it there, and so forth. I think one of the things that you need to have early on in the game is to develop a basic knowledge of how government works on all levels. What's the difference between a Maryland state senator and a United States senator? How does the House of Representatives differ from the United States senator? Who are the elected officials in the area who are in Congress? And then be aware of the world around you. You've got to be curious. You want to ask questions. If you see something driving down the highway that looks interesting, well, pull over and take pictures of it or make some notes, and then you might follow up with that on a story. I've often said that I think 4 years in the news business is tantamount to 4-year education in college. There are things that I have become familiar with, such as court cases, planning and zoning issues that I would have never been exposed to, that I've gotten to know an awful lot about, and it just gives you a well-rounded approach to the material that you're writing.
Well, obviously, you have developed a very significant interest and knowledge about ships and boats, and that has been helped you, I would assume, considerably in your writing as well. And the book we've got that you've given us, Lost Chester River Steamboats, is an example. You're going to retire in August, I understand, from journalism. What kind of writing projects do you have on the boards for the future?
I've actually got several, and all but one of them is maritime in nature. Surprise!
We would have suspected that.
The one that I've actually started to work on, I preface that by saying I've been collecting material for all of these projects over a long period of time, but I'm actually throwing this one into high gear now, and that's to write a book about those steamboats that went across the Atlantic during World War II, because it was just such an unusual event, and it's not widely known. For the longest time during the war, they were saying, well, this wasn't a real convoy. It wasn't really needed for anything. It was a decoy to lure the submarines away from a more important convoy. I don't think that was the case. These ships had a reason to go over to the UK, and they were used, and the record shows that they were used. So that's the first one that I would like to do. And then I'd like to write a history of the Baltimore and Philadelphia Steamboat Company, which lasted almost 100 years and ran through the Chesapeake and Delaware Canal. And then because I got started in this interest with the overnight boats between Baltimore and Norfolk, I would really like to do a large format, highly illustrated history of those operations. The books that have been written are very, very good, but I would like to take it one step further with lots of illustrations. The picture telling is worth 1,000 words and all of that sort of thing. And amazingly, there are a fair number of color photographs out there, even though the era, you know, began so long ago. And then another one that's been suggested is that I take a series of profiles, historic profiles that I wrote back in 2006 when Queen Anne's County celebrated its 300th anniversary, a series of historic people from Queen Anne's County. And it's been suggested that I expand upon that and maybe make that into a book. So we'll see if it happens.
Well, Jack, I can tell that in retirement you're not going to be sitting around and your two fingered mm-hmm. typing is going to be rattling away in your office at home. Thank you for joining us today on Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. We certainly look forward to reading your next book mm-hmm. and your future books. And thank all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.